here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden have different ideas on how to create economic growth over the next 4 years. We'll compare their plans on taxes and the economy and the impact they're likely to have. First, Halloween is quickly approaching, making it a great time to consider reading something a little scary. Legendary horror author Stephen King recently joined The Late Show with Stephen Colbert to talk about his new book and why some of us find comfort in turning to horror stories, especially when times are tough.
When you finish, you close the book and you've had a place to put your fears for a little while. You've been able to say, these problems are much worse than my problems. And then you close the book and you can go to bed and sleep like a baby. At least that's the theory.
Stephen King's books aren't always very kid-friendly, at least for the younger ones, but kids are a big audience for scary stories. Sometimes they like to be scared. There are a lot of classic best-selling scary books for children, like the popular Goosebumps series or the recently made into a movie book, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark by Alvin Schwartz. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you enjoy reading or hearing scary stories when you were young? What was your favorite? How about now? Do you read scary fiction with your kids or just as an adult? What do you like about being scared? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Catherine Schuffs is the Youth Services Librarian and Assistant Director at Aram Public Library in Delavan. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, what do you see when you're working with kids? What is it they like about being scared by a scary book?
You know, there's a lot of different factors that can play in, and each kid is very different on what they find scary or not scary. But one of the really great things about scary books for kids is not only do they provide those thrills and chills, but they also validate fears they have and empowers them to defeat those fears, which is something that can mean a lot. You know, sometimes it's all in your head. It's all in your imagination. And it gives them a chance, like Stephen King said, to work through their fears in the books, but also know that there's something that can be defeated too. Like they can handle it, and it helps prepare them for when they deal with not so stellar stuff in real life too. So that's something kind of cool about scary books. It's fun to be scared, but it's also fun to know that these terrifying things can be defeated and that you have the power to do so.
Is this something you used to like, if you remember back that far, reading as a kid?
Yes, I definitely loved reading scary stories. I definitely did the scary stories to tell in the dark. I did R.L. Stine, both Goosebumps, and then Fear Street later when I was older, Christopher Pike, Benicula, all that sort of stuff. Like I found that I really loved scary stories. I also really like ghost stories and that sort of thing as well. It's always been something I've enjoyed reading.
You mentioned that one book that's great for one kid when it comes to scary stuff might not be great for another. What do you say to parents, especially for younger kids, about finding the right match, something that'll be the right kind of scary for their kids?
Sure. Well, one thing, obviously parents are going to know their kids best. So if you have someone who's a little more squeamish or like easily scared, there are some really great books you can offer that are more creepy than scary, but a lot of it is going to be knowing your child. And also what's really great about horror in children's books is they're not there to like terrify the children, you know,
not.
Like they're not there trying to create these horrifying things. They're showing them that they're scary things that they can then overcome. And what's also really great about children's books is for some of them, they're quite short. So you could always read through them or be prepared to talk and read them with your kids or ahead of time as well. Also, ask your friendly bookseller or local librarian because they would be able to create a really nice list of things that'll suit your child and things that you are looking for.
We're talking to Catherine Schuffs from the Aram Public Library in Delavan, talking about great scary reads for kids and teens, and maybe some grown-ups in there, too. Mm-hmm. You could join in with your recommendations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's a book you remember from being a kid that was scary in a fun way, or something you've read to your own kids, or maybe something in that YA sweet spot that's going to be great for teens and grown-ups, too. 800-642-1234. Well, Catherine, let's name some more names, and let's go young first, and maybe those picture books that will be that quick read for the parent to flip through first and then share with a kid.
Sure. So one of my favorite scary storybooks is actually called Creepy Carrots, and it's by Aaron Reynolds and illustrations by Peter Brown. And it's about a little bunny who thinks he's being haunted and hunted by carrots. Right, exactly. And I won't spoil the ending, but it's a lot of fun. And then there's a second book in that series with the same bunny, and it's called Creepy Pair of Underwear, which is very silly. The book glows in the dark. That's a lot of fun. But it also sort of not only shows like the scary part, but also shows that even though something might be new and different, that change may be good and you might appreciate it more later on. So that one's pretty cool. There's a book called The Dark by Lemony Snicket, who also wrote the series of Unfortunate Events. And the illustrator is John Klassen. And it's all about a boy who's afraid of the dark until the dark invites him one day to come visit him in the basement. Again, won't spoil the ending, but those are two really fun ones. And there's quite a few. Some can be very silly, like Quit Calling Me Monster, or Go Away, which is by Jory John and Bob Shea, or Go Away, Big Green Monster by Ed Emberley. And those are ones where they get a chance to respond back. And for the Go Away monster, they can actually say, like, go away. And it's another way to empower them and make them feel like they have control. And even though there's these monsters out there, they don't have to let them scare them. So that's pretty cool. The monster at the end of the book, it's a classic. If anyone knows the Grover book, yep. So that one is always, always fun.
I'm going to jump in, Catherine, and say if people are hastily scribbling, Catherine gave us some links. We've got a few posted at WPR.org/Central Time. You can find a lot of great recommendations for kids of varying ages there. You had a couple more little kid ones, Catherine.
I sure do, yeah. The Little Old Lady Who Was Not Afraid of Anything by Linda Williams and illustrated by Megan Lloyd is fun because it's one of those repeating books. This little old lady is walking home and she starts being followed by a pair of shoes and a pair of pants. And there's lots of actions that the kids can do along the way while this lady is currently trying to escape the clothes that are following her through the woods. So there's a lot of really, really fun ones out there, and some that don't even give you like an ending, but just show that it's okay to be scared and still take chances. There's one book. Some of these books are new, by the way, and some of them are older classics. Do Not Go In There by Ariel Horn and Izzy Burton was another really fun one that I recently read. It's a new book, and it's two monsters, very cute monsters, and they see a door. And one of the monsters wants to go in the door. Like, there's probably puppies and, like, happy things. And the other one is like, absolutely not. There are wolves in there. It's crazy. You know, like, we're not going to go inside this door. So it's kind of fun to see where their imaginations take them on both ends.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Ben?
Oh, I know you guys touched on Goosebumps already, but I just remember when I was a child, I had a lot. Like, I believe they were numbered, so I remember being well into the double digits. And I just, when I was a child, I was a scared child, like, from probably 5 to 10. I would take my sleeping bag into my parents' room and sleep in there. And I didn't know if you could, your guests could possibly touch on what would have drawn me to being scared. To read those types of books from like maybe 10 to 13 when I was already such a scared, I don't know what I was scared of, but you would think I would shy away from that type of, I mean, they weren't terrifying. I mean, anyone who's read those, they were child.
I gotcha, Ben. Well, and Catherine, that fits into what you were talking about earlier, that maybe the right level of scary book is actually something that's going to help kids work through the things that they're scared of, or just sort of the general sense of being scared.
Right. And in that same vein, like we were saying, it would also be something where, you know, when you finished your Goosebumps book, even though you were still scared after and it's still stuck in your mind, which most good stories do in some way or another, you also knew that you were in a safe space. You were able to close that book. You were able to step away. And again, it gave you that feeling of empowerment that even though it was scary and it might linger with you, you're not stuck in that moment.
Thanks a lot for that call, Ben. We're talking to Catherine Schuffs, Youth Services Librarian and Assistant Director at Aram Public Library in Delavan. We are talking about scary books for kids of all ages, maybe even some good books that grown-ups and teens can enjoy as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with maybe some suggestions of your own, or if you need a suggestion to read to a kid, maybe on Halloween, or to read your own self, Catherine might have some ideas for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with a Wisconsin librarian about scary books for kids. Catherine Schuffs is with us, Youth Services Librarian at Aram Public Library in Delavan. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's your experience with horror fiction? Are you a fan or not? Do you have some childhood favorites from your own childhood or maybe that of your kids? Do you need a recommendation? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go back to our callers now. Christine is with us in Milwaukee. Christine, hello.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My big memory of my childhood with scary books was Nancy Drew books. I found The Hidden Staircase on my mom's bookshelf. It was her childhood book, and I was hooked after that one. And so birthdays and Christmases, I would get those books, and I couldn't wait. And I still actually have them. The old blue and also the yellow bound ones.
Oh yeah.
So Nancy Drew.
Yeah, I had the Hardy Boys equivalent, Christine. They were kind of gender separated back in those days. But Catherine, Nancy Drew. If somebody likes that kind of thing, there's sort of a mystery element, but they were kind of scary stories, as I dimly recall. What other things would you point them toward?
Sure. I mean, there's quite a few different things that you could do for older readers. Like, say it's someone who started with Nancy Drew and maybe wants to go in to something a little more advanced. The Jacoby series by William Ritter is really great. It's about a female investigator who has the ability to sense the supernatural. In the meantime, there's also a serial killer on the loose. So there's that sort of juxtaposition where the local law enforcement is like, it's obviously just a cut and dry, not cut and dry, but it's not supernatural. So that's kind of cool because it definitely twists in the mystery and the detective work on top of doing a little bit of scary. So that's pretty cool. For one that's not necessarily super creepy, but still has monsters, The Jumbies by Tracy Baptiste is like trickster monsters going around. So that's pretty neat. The Spirit Hunters by Ellen O. combines both ghost story and adventure, so that one's a lot of fun as well. The Dollhouse Murders, too, by Betty Wren Wright. It's about this girl whose dollhouse, like the family of dolls in her dollhouse, reenact an unsolved murder of the great-grandparents. And so she has to figure out what's going on because it just does little vignettes all the time. So there's the mystery on top of like the scary, creepy dolls, unsolved murder sort of thing.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, I know all kids are different, but with the ones you just mentioned, what kind of age range do you kind of have in your mind there?
Sure. So for the Dollhouse Murders and Spirit Hunters, a lot of those can be sort of in the juvenile. So they're into chapter books, but they're not quite hitting the teen. Like they're not quite reading YA just yet, though these would still be good books for older kids to read as well. Like they're still fantastic stories. As for the Jacoby, that is definitely a teen. That is aimed at teenagers.
Well, let's follow that up. Yeah, let's get into that. There's a lot, this young adult explosion that happened, I don't know, it started 20 years ago or I don't know when, but there's a lot of books that are going to be satisfying for teens and still enjoyable for grown-ups too. What are some of your favorites
definitely,
in that zone?
Definitely. So I mentioned Jacoby, The Monstromologist by Rick Yancey is a series. It is about an orphan assistant to a doctor of monstromology, the study of monsters. And there's grave diggers. Now be noted, this is definitely aimed at older teens and adults because it does not shy away from the gore.
Okay.
It definitely gets super creepy. So this is one, like, this is definitely aimed at older kids. The House of Fury series by Madeline Rue. It's sort of like set in a Victorian time, and a girl joins a staff in a house that turns out to be more than it appears, because folks who are evil are drawn there to be judged and taken care of by the staff. as you will take that. Another super creepy one, which is also really great for the teens that might not feel as comfortable reading like a big chapter book, or just folks who like graphic novels in general, Through the Woods by Emily Carroll is a collection of 5 stories. Super duper creepy. Very creepy. Very good, but very creepy. Like, it's definitely one of those, like, with the light on, not Home Alone sort of books. Yes.
So I better steer clear then. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Peter is with us in Heartland. Peter, hi.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, I'd just like to share my thought with Stephen King. When I was growing up, beyond the Go, Dog, Go, the way that I learned to read was with my mother. We sat down and we started reading Stephen King. Taking turns reading pages and stuff. Now, we started with Firestarter. It's a pretty, somewhat tame on Stephen King level. I just really think it was a great thing that my mom did. I mean, she instilled this horror in me, but starting out tame. Now, it is a slippery slope. Because Stephen King has things that are tame, like Firestarter, but there are just way over the top, too scary for a young adult, obviously. But it's just the thought that you could start with Stephen King as a child, and I'm still an adult, and I'm still reading Stephen King books and enjoying them.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. It's a great story. Stephen King and, Clive Barker and Neil Gaiman, who write pretty scary stuff that's probably not in the kids' zone, all of them, and I think a lot of other authors like them, have a young adult or younger reader books that you might be able to recommend, Catherine?
Sure. Well, Neil Gaiman writes for all ages. He even has picture books for those who are interested, but they're not scary, so I'm not going to talk about those right now. But he wrote Coraline. He wrote the Graveyard book. Those are some really great. M is for Magic is a collection of short stories that he did as well for Neil Gaiman. Also, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which is technically an adult book, is something that teens could also read as well. And that one's a really short read, but it's very creepy. The other two don't really have as many children's books per se, but Neil Gaiman definitely has some. So if you wanted to sort of test the waters with that, and then if they really love it, what's great is there are so many other books by that author and similar to that author.
Right, I was thinking more YA for Stephen King, and I think Clive Barker has one. But yeah, I don't think they have any children's readers, definitely not. I don't know if I'd want to buy them if they did.
I think Stephen King did technically have a picture book, but it was more like about – it was not meant for children. So there's that. So
noted.
Take that with a grain. Yeah.
Thanks again for the call, Peter. We're talking about scary reads for kids of all ages. Catherine Schuffs is with us from Delavan, a librarian there. I understand you are still a horror reader as a grown-up. Catherine, do you want to hit the grown-ups with a couple ideas for their own reading purposes?
Sure. So one book, and I need to look up the author, that I read recently that was quite creepy was Hex by, of course, my thing doesn't want to work, but Hex, I can send you the author in just a moment, was really good. It's about a town that is cursed by a witch that haunts them, and they're not allowed to have social media. They can't take pictures of her, and the teens would like their town back. Like, they don't want to have to deal with this, crazy centuries-old witch. It's by Thomas Old Huvelt. Also, Mexican Gothic, which you probably have seen on a lot of books, is a really fun, really dark sort of gothic tale. Very creepy, lots of weird family history. And that's by Silvia Moreno Garcia. So those are two really good ones. And again, some of these YA books I would definitely recommend as well. There's some really great ones. The Neil Gaiman books. The Chaos Walking series, which is soon going to be made into a motion picture with Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley by Patrick Ness. The Knife of Never Letting Go isn't a ghost story, but it is very creepy. It's like a creepy adventure, dystopian sort of thing. I would highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. Also, Far, Far Away by Tom McNeil is a... I can't say it's a modern day fairy tale because they don't really say like what time period it takes place in, but it's a boy who can communicate with ghosts, and he has sort of like a long term companion with the ghost of Jacob Grimm of the Grimm brothers.
Wow.
Meanwhile, while this is all happening, there's also a finder of occasions. He keeps hearing about this who wants to stop the boy who can communicate with ghosts. And this is one of those books I read all the way through. The audiobook is also fantastic, and it just weaves in things so very well. It's a teen book that adults would definitely enjoy as well.
Pretty cool. We've got some emails from listeners. Christine recommends The Goblins Will Get You If You Don't Watch Out. James Whitcomb Riley's Little Orphan Annie from 1975. Christine says it's fun to memorize and share with kids, young or old. Well, that's fun. Memorizing books and you know, reading with kids, Catherine. Any ones that fit that bill for you?
Sure. So are we thinking, so one of the things, you could look at the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which I know folks are familiar with.
Actually, and those I'll are jump really... in. Steve from Superior called in. He couldn't stay on, says he loves Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. So go run with that.
Yes, it's a good one. And so for some folks, you might remember the original illustrations by Stephen Gamble, which are delightfully terrifying. Like a lot of folks, when you bring it up, that's what they remember. There were also new illustrations by Brett Hellquist. But those are really great because they're short little stories. Some of them are even songs, and they'll divide them by like creepy, scary, funny, scary, you know, like sorts of things like that. And they're easy enough that you could memorize and tell by a campfire, tell at night, tell in the dark. And there's something really magical when you're able to tell a story out loud to kids and just like recite these tales to them. Like it's a whole different level of connection, and they can really get into the whole thing. So I would suggest that for sure. I mean, any shorts, and there's quite a few short story collections too. I know there's so many. You should see my list. It's crazy. It's so big.
Well, we'll leave it there, Catherine. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Catherine Schiffs is the Youth Services Librarian and Assistant Director at Arum Public Library in Delavan. You can follow them, by the way, at Instagram at Arum, A-R-A-M Library, for reading recommendations and a weekly Friday horror book reading, or on Facebook at Arum, again, A-R-A-M Public Library. Got some links up to book lists and resources. Find them at WPR.org/Central Time as well. Oh, and you can keep sharing your favorites, your favorite childhood scary book memories, ones you read to your kids now, maybe a YA horror book that teens and grownups will both enjoy. Head over and do that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are making their final week's worth of pitches to voters in Wisconsin and around the country. The economy is one of the big issues on the campaign trail as the U.S. deals with the COVID-19 related recession. President Trump has promoted tax cuts and high stock market numbers during his first term. Biden has said a fairer tax system and a jobs plan are part of his platform. And right now, we're talking about their different ideas and the impact they could have. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Which candidate appeals to you most on the issue of the economy? Have you been helped or hurt by President Trump's economic policies? Do you like what you've heard from Joe Biden? What aren't you hearing from either or both candidates that you would like to hear? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sam Thompson is a professor of law and director of the Center for the Study of Mergers and Acquisitions at Penn State Law School. He's the author of the book Biden versus Trump, Voter's Guide on Economics. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, there are some big economic challenges for whoever the president is in 2021. New stuff like the COVID-19 recession, longer-term structural problems like wealth inequality. What kind of issues are you hoping people keep an eye on when they think about the economy in this election?
Well, there are a lot of things. One, tax proposals, the various tax proposals of Biden versus Trump's proposals, their jobs plan, their plans for dealing with COVID-19. And then there are a lot of other issues such as minimum wage and a variety of other economic issues that a voter should be aware of.
That gives us a pretty good agenda of what we're going to talk about now. And let's start with taxes. What, first of all, are you seeing from the Biden campaign when they talk about what individuals are going to pay and what kind of rates they pay?
Well, first thing, individuals who make less than $400,000 are not going to see an increase in their income tax. But individuals who make over $400,000 will incur an increase in their taxes. Now, the increase is going to be not that significant. It will result from an increase in the top marginal rate from 37% to 39.6%. So it's just 2.6 percentage point increase in the top marginal rate, which is what Biden has proposed.
And on President Trump's side, he talks about the 2017 tax overhaul, Republicans in Congress, and he put that together. What kind of effect is that having on time on individual tax rates?
Well, one thing is clear. It gave higher income taxpayers a significant tax cut, and it gave moderate and low income taxpayers a tax cut, but not nearly as significant as the cut that those that are really wealthy received. And furthermore, you know, one of the really interesting and I think bizarre tax provisions in that 2017 Act is the deduction for business income, qualified business income. So that, for example, Trump's individual income from running his hotels and the like, that income is subject to a 20% deduction. So he gets an automatic 20% deduction on that income, which if he were in a top rate would reduce his tax liability from 37% to 29%. So, you know, so the question is, why in the heck are we giving wealthy folks a straight out deduction of 20% of their business income? Now, some will say, well, it's going to encourage individuals to engage in business activity. And my response to that is, yes, that may be true in the case of small entrepreneurs. I think it makes sense to give that kind of deduction maybe to small entrepreneurs, given the risk that they're taking. But for multimillionaire taxpayers, I don't think it makes any sense. And fortunately, one of the provisions that Biden has proposed would eliminate that benefit for high-income folks. As a matter of fact, I believe it would be phased out beginning at $400,000 of taxable income. I think that would be a significant improvement in the tax system. Keep it for low-income and moderate-income entrepreneurs, but deny it for high-income entrepreneurs.
A corporate tax rate, also an issue. I want to listen to a clip of the candidates talking about that in the first presidential debate.
So I'm going to make the corporate tax 28%. It shouldn't be 21%. You have 91 companies, in the Fortune 500, who don't pay a single penny in tax, making billions of dollars.
Why didn't you do it billions before of dollars? When you were vice president with Obama?
Because you, in fact, passed that. That was your tax proposal.
I got it done. And you know what happened?
Yeah, you got it done.
Our economy boomed boomed.
The economy.
Okay. Well, yes, a reminder of how the first debate went there. But Sam, corporate tax rate coming down, going back up, maybe under a Biden plan. What do you make of that?
Well, the first thing, when it comes to the corporate tax, and also in the case of the individual tax, you can't just focus on the rate. You got to focus on the base. How big is the tax base? How much taxable income do you have that's going to be subject to the tax rate? And one of the problems in our corporate system is that there are a ton of what's known as corporate tax preferences, which in essence give corporations breaks for this and breaks for that. And so in addition to the low corporate rate dropped from 35% to 21% as a result of Trump's tax act, the tax preferences weren't cut back. So yes, I think that Biden is probably right that we need to increase the tax rate to 28% or something higher than 21%, but we also need to close a significant number of those preferences, which are generally referred to as loopholes. There's significant loopholes in our corporate tax system, and we need to close them. And I believe that probably Biden's Treasury Department would look closely at closing those loopholes.
Talking to Sam Thompson from Penn State Law School, author of the book Biden versus Trump, Voter's Guide and Economics, looking at economic issues in the presidential race. You could join in with your questions and preferences at 800-642-1234. Sam, let's look at issues of concerns about growing wealth inequality in the United States. How big a problem do you see that being, first of all?
Well, I think it's a huge problem. And the main problem, I mean, it's a general problem, but there's a core issue here. And the core issue that I think our country faces is the inequality, the racial divide, the inequality and the racial divide. We are still living with the legacy of slavery and over 100 years of Jim Crow when it comes to black Americans, and also discrimination against Hispanic Americans and brown Americans. So I think that we've got to come to terms with this. We can't have two Americas, one living in relative wealth and another scrapping for a living. And the evidence on the wealth inequality, that is the actual wealth that a family has, is just horrendous. Whites in America have six times the wealth, the net worth of Hispanic Americans, and 10 times the wealth and net worth of black Americans. So, you know, we got to do something about those disparities. Now, the income disparity, the disparity in between blacks and whites and Hispanics and whites in income has been significantly decreasing over the past several years. Although, given that we are now in the pandemic, it's dramatically increased. But before the pandemic, it had begun to decrease during the Obama administration and during the Trump administration. Under both administrations, there was a decrease in the income inequality. But the wealth inequality is something that, in my judgment, from what I can see, will grow and has grown even as the income inequality has decreased. That is, when I say income inequality, the money that folks make from working, from having a job and the like, that there's been a closing of the gap there, but notwithstanding the closing of the gap there, the actual wealth gap has still been increasing. So we can't, I don't think we, as a country, I don't think we can sit by and say, okay, forever, white Americans are going to have 10 times more wealth than black Americans on average. I don't see us continuing to have that kind of disparity in our country.
We're talking to Sam Thompson right now, professor of law at Penn State, author of the book Biden versus Trump, Voter's Guide and Economics, looking at plans from both candidates and looking at some of the fundamental economic issues facing the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What candidate appeals to you most on the issue of things like jobs, taxes, and the overall economy? Do you think you've been helped or hurt by President Trump's policies? Do you like what you've heard from Joe Biden? Where do these issues fall? Where do they rank on your list of what you vote on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Sam Thompson from Penn State, author of the book Biden versus Trump, Voter's Guide on Economics, looking at how the two candidates compare on things like taxes and jobs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sam, looking at a job creation, there's sometimes the notion that a rising tide lifts all boats. Is that true when it comes to the wealth inequalities of the nation that you were talking about a few minutes ago?
That's a good question. a rising tide will lift all boats, as John F. Kennedy said. But applying that to the inequality issue and the income issue and the wealth issue in the United States, I think that it's more appropriate with respect to income than it is with respect to wealth. With respect to income, as the economy grows, virtually every segment of the economy is going to experience growth, which is consistent with the idea that that a rising tide will lift all boats. But I've never had this particular question, but I think that his analogy there is probably not opposite to to the wealth effect in the United States, because I think that a rising tide may reduce income disparities, but I'm not sure that a rising tide of jobs and the like will decrease the wealth disparity.
What would?
Okay, that's a very good question. And what would is, I'm going to mention something and people are going to cringe. But let me tell you, the person who first came up with this idea was one tough Civil War general, General Sherman. And his idea was to give slaves 20 acres and a mule to compensate them for their slavery. Now today we call that reparations. And virtually a whole bunch of people in this country are against reparations. But I think we got to think about the possibility of reparations. Now, I'm a black guy. Do I need reparations? Absolutely not. Does my son need reparations? Absolutely not. But there are a ton of black folks out there who today, because of no reason of their own, are locked into poverty. And why is it? It's because of the legacy of slavery and the legacy of Jim Crow and the fact that we had federal housing policy, for example, that discriminated against black folks for a long time. And, you know, we live in America, and in America, you know, the idea is, hey, you know, we treat people fairly and we remedy wrongs. If somebody was wrong, we remedy them. We remedy the wrongs. So folks will say, but you know, the wrong occurred 100 years ago, 200 years ago. That's right. The major wrong occurred 200 years ago. But when you think about what happened after the end of slavery with the Jim Crow laws that prevailed in the South and both overt and implicit discrimination that occurred throughout the country, you know, we haven't gotten over it. Now, can I just say one other thing here?
Then I want to get to a caller, so sure, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I just want to say one thing. I know some of you guys out there who are hearing me talk are saying, this guy's a communist. And I'm just telling you, I was a captain in the Marine Corps, and that's one of the things that I'm most proud of. And I'm nowhere near a communist. I'm a guy who believes in equity. And I think that equity is something that's fundamental to our American nature, and it's something that we should be striving for.
Let's bring on a caller now. Yordas is with us in Colfax. Yordas, hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the $15 minimum wage. That my husband has a second part-time job, and that would change our lives to get that increase in his pay. And especially during COVID, when his first job is income is just dwindled to a half or less, we're just struggling so much. And it would mean being able to buy a pair of socks if I need it, really, literally. There's a lot of people that live in rural areas that incomes are very low for labor that takes a lot. My husband is an essential worker. He's paid $10 an hour. He drives all over three counties. This is a job that takes a lot, and it puts him at risk. And he is paid very low for that work. And there's lots of jobs like that, daycare workers, you know, people that work for nonprofits, you name it. $15 would change this country because that money would go completely right into the economies of small towns and cities and tennis shoes, you know, buying extra food at a grocery store, you name it.
Yordis, I gotcha. Thanks for calling in, Sam. That's a policy debate out there, the idea of a $15 minimum wage.
Yeah, and Biden supports it, raising it gradually over a couple of years. I support it, but I have one caveat. I think that there ought to be an exception for, and let me just say, I don't want to say I think. I think we need to look carefully at the possibility of an exception for kids, you know, for teenagers who are working in McDonald's and the like. Do we want to give them a $15 an hour wage? I'm not sure that we do. Secondly, I think that there may be a case for having different minimum wages in different parts of the country. For example, in L.A., it may be appropriate to have a minimum wage of $20 an hour. Whereas in some small town in Mississippi, it might be appropriate to have a minimum wage of $12 an hour. So I would support the idea of having minimum wages that were tailored to the various geographical areas in which an individual was located. Now, I realize that there's a lot of complexity associated with that. Just one national minimum wage is a lot easier to administer, but I think that you could have an adverse effect on developing, particularly small businesses in towns and communities throughout this country where there's not significant enough income to support a $15 an hour wage.
Yordis, thanks a lot for calling in. And Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking to Sam Thompson, professor of law and director of the Center for the Study of Mergers and Acquisitions at Penn State Law School. He's author of the book Biden versus Trump, A Voter's Guide on Economics. He talked with us some about the plans from the two major candidates. You can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know which candidate you prefer when it comes to the economy and what economic issues are important to you. Is it taxes? Do you want certain taxes to go down or up depending on income levels? Are you worried about inequality, the minimum wage, job creation, trade, and tariffs? Let us know what's on your mind in this election season when it comes to economic issues. Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page.